This is Dory Smith for WHUS Stores, radio for the people at the University of Connecticut. Our guest today is Connecticut State Representative Patricia Dillon of New Haven. Her bill in the State House of Representatives passed overwhelmingly last month, but House Bill 6008 was then tabled, pending amendments as state lawmakers wrestle with the details of how to help soldiers who may have been exposed to depleted uranium from the bombs, artillery rounds, and bullets they used in Iraq. There are also House bills pending on the federal level, like one by Representative McDermott of Washington. H.R. 2410 would require health assessments, an EPA assessment, and studies regarding the health effects of exposure to depleted uranium munitions. It would also require the cleanup and mitigation of depleted uranium contamination at sites of DU munition use and production in the U.S. The battle to stop the U.S. military from making, using, and selling depleted uranium munitions has gone on for more than 15 years, as U.S. forces drop tons of the heavy metal during the bombing of the Balkans, Afghanistan, and Iraq. With each successive use of the bullets, cluster bombs, smart bombs, tank and artillery rounds made from DU, peace groups and veterans support networks have grown more alarmed. But they are up against a twisted trail of U.S. military denials. Rear Admiral Craig R. Quigley, for example, minimized the risks of DU at a Department of Defense briefing held in January of 2001. A 1995 Department of Defense report, in fact, confirmed that the entire stockpile of uranium used for DU weapons had been compromised. DU is uranium hexafluoride, created during the uranium enrichment process, but the military has now admitted that it also contains more deadly radioactive isotopes, plutonium, neptunium, americium, and U-236. One of the problems is that the DU story has not been adequately told in the mainstream media. The fourth most censored story of 2005 is high uranium levels found in troops and civilians in a book by Project Censored out by Seven Stories Press this year. Meanwhile, soldiers who have been found to have the heavy uranium in their bodies have been growing sick and even dying. An explosive report in the New York Daily News by Juan Gonzalez tells some of the stories of U.S. soldiers testing positive for DU. A leading radiation expert, Lauren Morette, explained that there is a super cover-up of the DU issue, not only in the U.S. and Canada, but in the NATO countries as well, she said. So veterans groups and peace groups agree that there will be U.S. soldiers and members of the National Guard returning from Iraq after dangerous DU exposures. The question of education about testing has become an emergency matter for those legislating on behalf of increased and improved testing for depleted uranium exposure among U.S. soldiers. Connecticut Representative Pat Dillon of New Haven has served in the state legislature for 10 terms. She's an assistant majority leader of the Connecticut House of Representatives and serves on the Finance, Revenue, and Bonding Committee, as well as the Higher Education and Judiciary Committees. Her background is in public health. She's earned her master's in that field from Yale University. Representative Dillon, welcome. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. I know you are in the middle of a very busy legislative session.
Oh, thank you so much for taking an interest in what we do.
We're talking about House Bill 6008. This is an act concerning exposure to depleted uranium by members of the armed forces. Why don't you talk a little bit about this bill and explain why you thought it was important to write?
When the Iraq War started, when the first interest was announced, or I guess it was really first leaked in the press, I was very concerned because I had worked partly as a citizen, really, although sort of vaguely as a legislator, with people who were Gulf One veterans, who were young people, who had been denied disability, who had a series of complaints that were symptoms that really shouldn't have been there, and they were sicker than they should have been, given their age. And it appeared that they weren't being listened to, and I started listening to people about the possible sources of exposure that could have caused their illness. And I actually found some of them through some of our own state programs for the indigent, because they weren't getting their health care bills paid for. And that was around 93, 94. And I had thought, you know, there was a time that we thought that a lot of, you know, the military actions would be scaled back, but that all changed. And so when preparations began for this war, I started looking at depleted uranium, because that seemed to be one exposure that was really in a little bit of a political paralysis, because the Department of Defense was kind of stonewalling any effect, and in turn, a lot of other people were engaging in speculation, but we had really very, very bad evidence, because we weren't giving an accurate test. So I started looking at the quality of the test and at the science of really how we would detect whether or not a soldier was exposed. So that's really what the genesis of the bill was. In terms of policy, I suppose you could say the emotional genesis was that someone I was very close to when I was younger, and not as an individual, but he was the older brother of one of my friends in eighth grade, was seriously wounded in Vietnam, and I learned a lot about the effects of war later on the people who are young and idealistic, who participate in that war, and his life was really totally shaped by his time in Vietnam. He lost both of his legs there in a landmine. He lost his eye. He had chronic surgery for the rest of his life. So I learned a lot about, I guess you could say it could be cynical, but I don't know if it's cynical, that that when the bandwagon passes by, you know, and the politicians jump on the next bandwagon, the young people who very often go out there very energetically in a very trusting way to carry out what we do are left behind, because we've moved on to another topic of the day, and I wanted to make sure that didn't happen this time.
The bill you wrote facilitates testing, and I want to talk with you more about that. There are various ways to test these soldiers and members of the Guard for depleted uranium exposure. But I understand a lot of veterans are contacting your office to ask about DU. Can you talk about some of the problems that they're sharing with you and what kinds of things they're asking you to help them with?
Well, a lot of the contacts began before filing the bill, but a lot of them were disability claims or tremendous anxiety about the kinds of symptoms they were experiencing, because they couldn't be attributed to anything. In a couple of cases, it took a lot of us a very long time to get people to take seriously the issue of post-traumatic stress syndrome, and I believe very strongly in providing some social support and mental health support for people who have gone through war and for their families when they're overseas. Ironically, it was starting to look like the breakthroughs that we had made on behavioral issues that soldiers experience were being used against them. That is, that people who were in their late 20s or early 30s who were coming back with very dramatic symptoms that were much greater than you would ever expect for someone that age were being told that they had post-traumatic stress, which was sort of I guess a way of saying it's all in your head. And it was very clear looking at the symptoms that they were not all in their head. So that I found a number of people, as you might expect, individually who were very distrustful in the way that you are if you feel betrayed, because they had trusted the government probably a lot more than I do, because I've been involved in it most of my adult life. I know how we can make mistakes as legislators, and I know how the executive branch can make mistakes. But they were young men, and they trusted our judgment, and some of them were very angry.
These would be people who would come home after serving in Iraq during the Persian Gulf War, Operation Enduring Freedom, and Operation Iraqi Freedom. So this is possibly recent exposure that they would be dealing with and coming home right now. As they come back to the state of Connecticut, what is there for them to help them understand whatever symptoms they might have and how they might be related to depleted uranium in the Iraq war zones?
Well, I think the training that they had was variable. Some branches of service got a lot of training, some did not. There has been progress in the military because, for example, in the National Guard, which is really the only branch of service that a state legislator has any cognizance over, it is now a common task to have some training on DU. But in theater, it appears that sometimes those protocols are not followed.
And the protocol that is initially offered is a basic urinalysis screening. Why wasn't that sufficient when soldiers were afforded that? I understand not a lot of soldiers have received that test, but why is that test not sufficient?
Well, it is sufficient if you have a simple urine test within 72 hours of exposure. But that really means testing people in theater. And it also, it's a voluntary system that relies on your having full information to make that kind of voluntary choice. You have to know what you're being exposed to, and you have to be able to request that. There was a directive issued in the Army, for example, in April of 2004, after there was a tremendous controversy about New York National Guardsmen who had tested negative under the Army test, but tested positive under an independent test. And at that time, I think his name was Colonel Peake, restated what he said was existing Army policy, that every soldier should be assigned a risk level, which I won't go into the details of the risk level, but it would be level 1, 2, and 3, based on your level of exposure, whether you were handling certain kinds of materials, whether or not you were within 50 yards of a certain kind of discharge, and that those people should be informed of the test. Now, that happened in spring of 2004. Of course, you know, things that people have already been exposed by then. But even now, people who are still in the chain of command or who have recently returned from Iraq are contacting me at home and telling me that is not being routinely followed. And there are a lot of reasons for that. It doesn't mean necessarily that there are bad actors. Depending on where you're stationed, it may have to do with the chaos of what happens in theater. Or it may be that some units were trained better than others, or it may differ by branch of service. It's really hard for me to say. I do know that some of the people who are talking about it, who are in the chain of command, not people who are necessarily, let's say, at the infantry level, are telling me that there are a number of public health measures that they're concerned about, that they believe that we were very sloppy about over there. So that I'm addressing depleted uranium. If I were to quote what I've heard from some of the people who could not testify, who are intensely loyal to the military and to their mission, have talked to me about water supplies being contaminated. They've talked to me about rabid dogs wandering all over Iraq and the lack of any kind of rabies vaccine. They've talked to me about soldiers who have serious wounds being brought to stations that are colonized by bacteria that's resistant to antibiotics. So that I'm focusing on DU because it's something where it's an open question and where I think we need to get a test that gives us the evidence so that we can show what's happening to these soldiers. But I do want to say that the depleted uranium issue was not the only thing that I heard about this time around from people who are in the military. I heard about a lot of things on the public health side that people who are very committed to their branch of service believe has been very sloppily planned by the people with desk jobs in Washington.
We're talking with Connecticut Representative Pat Dillon. Representative Dillon, I did ask some questions in and around the veterans' health care system of Connecticut and nationally. In the National Veterans Office that I called, there was a gentleman kind enough to speak with me, and he said that the office has not formulated an opinion yet on depleted uranium, but we don't want a repeat of Agent Orange. Will you talk a little bit about that whole legacy of Agent Orange and what some of the parallels are?
Well, I think one of the parallels, you know, that's the clearest was the government stonewalling. And the reaction on the part of some folks in the military, which was total distrust of anything that came out of the government. and also a belief that some of the studies that were funded by the government, as in the case of DU, were inadequate. You know, when you're looking at an epidemiological question, you don't look at whether somebody's exposed and whether something shows up within 60 days. That's not long enough. That's number one. Number two, I guess if the study simply measures what happens with one exposure if you're 50 feet away, I'm not sure that tells you much either, because what's happening is, let's say, if this powder is going, these particles are going through the air, you may not actually inhale something on the first go-round, but those particles attach to your polyester uniforms, which means that unless you have a hot wash every day, and if you ask somebody if they have a daily laundry, they would laugh at you in Iraq, you're getting re-exposed over and over again. There is a randomness to who gets exposed that very often has something to do with prevailing winds, from what I can see. But we really have not done the kind of longitudinal information that would credibly support anything that the government has been saying, which is, just like in Agent Orange, they're claiming that there's no problem with DU. I don't believe that. I don't assign magical properties to it either, but it is a heavy metal. And I think that's what the issue is here, because the symptoms I'm looking at are not consistent with radiation poisoning. I don't think the radioactive properties are dispositive. They're important, and they contribute, and they have something to do with the amount of time it takes for the material to degrade in the human body and how long it takes you to excrete it. But it appears that a lot of the symptoms are more consistent with some sort of heavy lead poisoning. Depleted uranium is heavier than lead, and it's useful. It's a very, very heavy metal, and it's cheap. But we haven't really looked enough at how it affects the human body. And in the meantime, there are a lot of human beings out there who are exposed, and it's not right. We should be taking care of people who put their lives on the line. There's absolutely no substitution for the integrity of the human body, and we shouldn't be able to violate people like that when they were willing to put their lives on the line in the military.
Representative Dillon, you have a health background and actually a master's degree from Yale University in public health in 1998, right?
Right.
So you, of all the representatives in this country, would really get this. And with your expertise on AIDS and other issues like mental illness that you've taken on, some of the really difficult challenges of our time, Do you see now that people are starting to listen to you? I mean, are you getting the sense that they're understanding it now that you've had this positive vote in the Connecticut legislature on House Bill 6008?
Well, we'll see what happens. It's not over yet, but we're certainly working on it. I think people are aware, but yeah, certainly the work I did on AIDS is very similar. To me, you go where the problems are. The politics don't matter to me. If somebody has a health problem and they're underserved, you go and help them. So that at one time AIDS was very controversial. The people who were getting AIDS in the 1980s and 1990s were not it was not a popular issue in the beginning. It was very hard, and there was a lot of uncertainty about how people were getting AIDS, and there was a lot of denial. And in the military, maybe in a different part of the military of the spectrum, again looking at military problems, I think in the beginning there was a lot of denial, this time from our government, and it was clearly a group that needed our attention. And because it appeared that there was a vacuum at the federal level, and as a state legislator, the National Guard is our folks, and this is a very different war. Almost half of the people who are in theater are National Guard. We've used the National Guard overseas before, but usually it would be for maybe 30 days, maybe 60 days. Somalia, they went over. But to have someone in theater for 18 months when they're not adequately trained, and originally their disability payments and their health care when they came back were not adequate, that's changed actually just before this last election. So that this is what we should be doing.
Now, talk a little bit about this issue. The National Guard does not have the tri-state health coverage that regular members of the Army would have. Is that right?
Well, this is in play now. There are a lot of changes that are being made. But when we first went to war, the National Guard members did not have the same health benefits when they came back as people who were in the regular military. And that was one of the things that was really jumped out at me when I was researching this. It looked like the people in Washington were using the National Guard sort of as a temp agency because they didn't have the same obligation to them in terms of pension or in terms of health benefits that they did to people who were in the traditional services. They also, in the National Guard, have a set of skills in terms of, you know, nation building and in terms of doing work, which actually could make them very helpful, but they didn't get the same kinds of support. I think that's changing very gradually, and a lot of people are taking leadership on that. Lindsey Graham and Hillary Clinton worked together to work on the National Guard. Those of us in Connecticut set up a mental health benefit for non-traditional families, because even if you fix it at the federal level, the reality is about a quarter of the National Guard is non-traditional families. They're not married. Maybe they're living together. They're blended families. They don't fit the old one-size-fits-all benefit structure. So even if they start equalizing that in Washington, it's not going to take care of everybody who's over there. You have a lot of single mothers. They have to work out all kinds of issues with taking care of their children when they're over there, so that all of those things really require a lot of detail work. And the second is, of course, that we have no requirement that a provider accept TRICARE. So that, you know, a lot of the folks in the Guard used to call TRICARE, try to get care. Because even when you get it, which in itself originally was a struggle, there are some providers who wouldn't accept it. You know, some hospitals wouldn't accept it, some doctors wouldn't accept it. That's embarrassing. And I did file a bill to try to make it mandatory. I know there are a number of people up here at the Capitol who are trying to negotiate with some providers, but it's amazing to me that everybody should be waving the flag and saying, you know, they support the war and so forth, and all the sacrifice should be borne by one or two people. If it isn't a society benefit and we are not willing to all share the burden, then we shouldn't be there. It's not right to have some folks go over there and get exposed and then not be able to get a doctor when they come home. It's simply wrong.
You've said in the past that a lot of these members of the National Guard are also people who will be losing their jobs after they get home. Talk a little bit about the problems of the National Guard and how something like a depleted uranium exposure could hit a family very, very hard if health consequences do occur.
Well, it's interesting you should mention that, because theoretically, it's a violation of federal law to take somebody's job away because they are serving overseas. And I just was contacted last week by a family where, ironically, because of some of the changes that have been made on the healthcare side, this person who came back from Iraq is getting healthcare himself, but his wife is pregnant, and she has no health care because he lost his job while he was over there. And, you know, going through the courts, that's even before you get to depleted uranium. Your family may have lost their health benefits. And so that's very dramatic. On the issue with uranium, it really depends, if I can use their language, on how badly is that. There could be some kind of chelation available. You might be able to be treated. But obviously, if people are denying that you're sick or you're not getting disability or they're claiming that it's post-traumatic stress, which is amazing, when you hear some of the symptoms, you couldn't imagine that some of the things that are happening to people could be something that would happen as a result of depression. It simply doesn't work. But yes, it's very, very hard for the whole family. And if the people that I knew, my girlfriend's older brother, for example, or anything like some of the folks, you know, that are coming back now. I mean, very often, depending on how intense your experience was over there, there's always an adjustment period within the family. Very often, if the person saw a particular kind of combat, sometimes that means that they really feel more comfortable with other people who have been in theater than they do with their own families. It takes a tremendous amount of work to reintegrate for some people, not for all. It may vary depending on what the relationship was like before you went over there. It may vary depending on how much your community and your family can deal with it. Your own injuries may affect it. And the other part may simply be where you were stationed and what happened to you there. It varies.
Now, you mentioned the U.S. Army Surgeon General's report, I believe it's 1995, Lieutenant General James B. Peek. And that, actually, it's April 29, 2004.
Right.
And it indicates that depleted uranium bioassays be administered to individuals with level 1 and level 2 exposures.
Right.
And that they would be provided upon request. And then again, the question becomes, who should be tested and how are they identified? Because apparently in level 1 exposure, for example, you have personnel who were either in, on, or near combat vehicles at the time that they were struck by depleted uranium rounds. So you either have friendly fire or you have someone who's going out into a tank that's been hit by one of these 10-pound uranium artillery rounds from the U.S., and that's very specific. Do you find that those kind of specifics from the military are getting in the way of what needs to be done here for testing?
No, I think what Colonel Peek did was very positive, and what he did is not being followed. It may well be that we need more, and the language of our bill goes a little bit further. At least it looks at your exposure a little bit more. In Gulf War One, actually, they looked at your branch of service instead of your health exposure. So you could say that someone who was in regular Army would be allowed to have a test. National Guard were not considered combat, so they didn't get access to a test. You could be the person who was going into a Bradley to clean it up and pick up contaminated pieces, and you wouldn't be getting a test because you were in the Guard. So that they were going on very rigid bureaucratic categories that had very little to do with health exposure. Now, I'm not saying that everything that Colonel Peek did was perfect, but I think it was so much more advanced than anything that we had before, and frankly, it's not being followed. If I rely on some of the people who were there, they say that it's not always happening. Not everybody with a risk level is being told that they have the right to a test. What we're doing on the state level is late. I mean, we shouldn't have to do a more expensive test 6 months after you've been exposed. But if you're not getting a test in theater within, really, 72 hours is optimal. After 30 days, much less of it shows up in the urine. It goes to your bones and your kidney. It's much, much harder to detect. People are telling me that after 30 days after exposure, maybe 1/1,000th of your actual exposure is going to show up in the urine. And so it's not a substitute for doing it right there in Iraq. They should be doing it. We're just trying to take care of our own folks.
Representative Pat Dillon, share with us finally what's going on at the legislature that, you know, may affect this bill and its implementation. I know there's an awful lot of activity right now, and bills are passing, it seems, almost every day now.
That's right.
So do you think that this bill has a chance to be passed during this session?
Well, we still have a lot of big bills to go. I'm still hopeful, and we're looking at it right now. I think we have a budget. We have some ethics reforms. There's a lot. We're doing stem cell today. But I'm very optimistic. We'll keep trying.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
State Representative Pat Dillon of the 92nd Assembly District is Assistant Majority Leader. Contact her office at 1-800-842-8267. Veterans groups are asking people to call their representatives to push for immediate implementation of Pat Dillon's bill on DU in Connecticut and Representative McDermott's federal bill. For further information about DU legislation, try the Lone Star Iconoclast at iconoclast-texas.com or traprockpeace.org. I'm Dori Smith.
This program was produced in the studios of WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. For further information, write to me at theshockvote@yahoo.com.